Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Can everybody hear me? Okay, great. So first of all, I'm delighted to be here. I landed in Glasgow a few hours ago, and as I went through passport control, the gentleman asked me where I was going, what I was going to be doing here, and I told him I was going to be giving a lecture, a public lecture about the effects of stress, and he just asked me what it was about. And all the people are waiting in the lines. And I told him it was about epigenetics and the effects of stress on the next generation. And he really wanted to hear more. And I said, it's going to be on the web, and what about those people over there? So he let me go. And it really, it's great because what I felt was that this is a culture where these issues are important and interesting, and so it is good. I want to begin the talk, though, by showing you a few pictures, and then we can talk about what these are pictures of. Well, I think that it's clear what we can conclude from these pictures. There's nobody here that wouldn't know that these are pictures taken after something catastrophic has happened, either directly or indirectly to somebody. And not only that, we know that whatever it is that happened probably just happened. And the reason that we know that is because fear, shock, helplessness, horror, and grief are responses to tragedy and trauma that are immediate and relatively short-lived, and they're universal responses, so that we could expect that anybody who undergoes a catastrophe or a trauma or a terrible event would have a similar reaction and would look the same way no matter what happened or in what culture that it happened. And our field of stress has been very focused on these immediate, quick responses to stress and to trauma and to tragedy. And our biology that has been described in the scientific literature has really focused on the immediate, universal, acute effects. And the idea here is that probably if you photographed these people a day later, a week later, a month later, they wouldn't look like this. You may or may not be able to observe a change in their outer demeanor. You certainly probably would not observe a change in their stress hormones. So the idea of focusing on a short-term biology that has been very well described is helpful. But what we haven't been talking about enough, I think, and what we don't really have a full biology for, is the idea that effects of trauma can be enduring and transformative. Something happened to that slide. But it's this realization that led to the concept of post-traumatic stress disorder. And until 1980, the mental health literature also did not have a concept for a chronic effect of an event. They had transient situational disturbance, which was the forerunner for adjustment disorder. But if people seemed to hang on to traumatic effects, this was considered a problem that they had. It wasn't considered that an event did it. And so this was a really big concept. And post-traumatic stress disorder is a condition that occurs following trauma exposure, and it represents a failure to recover from the immediate effect of a trauma. That's how it was conceptualized, that somehow, even though the trauma is clearly in the past, there's no immediate threat or challenge. There's a response as if the person is even under the threat or feels some residual feeling. As one combat veteran put it, the war is still over in my head. And many of the symptoms of PTSD revolve around the memories of the traumatic event. These memories are very vivid, they're often unwanted, they're uncontrollable, they come in the form of nightmares. And then there are other symptoms that the person has: avoidance to try to distance themselves from reminders of the trauma, hypervigilance symptoms, the physiological symptoms of arousal and irritability, insomnia. Now, one of the things that was not anticipated when the diagnosis was established in 1980 is the fact that not all trauma-exposed persons develop PTSD. In fact, the concept was really meant to distinguish between the effects of stress, which were conceptualized as effects that really were short-lived and were pretty much accommodated to once the stressor was removed, and the idea that some events would produce more long-lasting symptoms. And I think that it's been challenging for the field, this idea that not all trauma-exposed persons develop PTSD. In fact, the majority don't. It depends on what has happened. But that's been an interesting wrinkle in all of this. And again, science has more trouble with the idea that something happens, but the effects are not uniform. And how do we begin to understand individual differences and how they interact with traumatic experiences? Now, what we do know is that in persons who do seem to have a chronic response to trauma, the effect is very long-lasting and can even be transmitted to the next generation. I mean, trauma survivors will tell you that they're never going to go back to their former selves. The event has changed them, and they feel transformed by it, so much so that the transformation continues into the next generation. And today, what I'd like to do is talk about this idea of enduring effects, transformative effects, what that might mean for the trauma survivor, the first generation trauma survivor, but also what it might mean for the second generation trauma survivor. And I'm going to tell you about work that really started 20 years ago, believe it or not. Sounds like a really long time ago. And when it began, wasn't clear that where it was going to go exactly and how it would evolve. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about how it started and where it's ended. And I think that I feel a little apologetic when I talk about adult children of Holocaust survivors, because I feel I have to justify what it was that made me want to study this group. I'm often asked if I am a child of Holocaust survivors, and I'm not. And so I think you need a really good reason to study long-term effects on people. But fortunately, Holocaust offspring have been extremely prolific in the arts and literature, and they have used the arts to portray the Holocaust's impact on them personally. And they've done it in many, many ways, in many venues. Here I've given you some example of one of the major works that came out around 1991 was Art Spiegelman's comic book, Mouse. If you haven't read it, it's fabulous. It's about his reflections on the Holocaust's impact on his father and also on him. And in this clip, he says, "I never felt guilty about Rishu, his brother that was killed in the Holocaust, but I did have nightmares about SS men coming into my class and dragging all us Jewish kids away. Don't get me wrong," he's saying to his wife, "I wasn't obsessed with this stuff. It's just that sometimes I'd fantasize Zyklon B coming out of the shower instead of water." And here's some of the art. You see Miri Lavie, mother and child. She draws fusion of bones where you cannot tell where the mother and child are separated. And in this photographic art by Ricard Horowitz, you see a little baby being saved by a vulture, but the alternative isn't so good either. And there's lots of different examples. perhaps in poetry is where you get some of the deepest expressions, and I had a hard time picking one poem, but I did pick this one. I'm going to share it with you. It's called Shielded. It's written by a child of Holocaust survivors. You are encased in a transparent shield that lets you move and flex yourself, but not fully. You hug, but not fully. I feel you there, almost in reach, but cannot get to you fully. In truth, there is no shield, for we reside within one skin. Your breath, when it is short, makes me gulp for air. When you cannot walk, I limp. When you gird yourself, I stiffen. I turn to me and find myself not fully there. And obviously, she's writing about her mother. So, does this have a biology? And is it even really a universal phenomenon? How I came to this story wasn't just, I'm not in the habit of doing research every time I read a poem. We were doing work on trauma survivors with post-traumatic stress disorder, first combat veterans, and then in an attempt to really examine the generalizability of the work in combat veterans, we had the idea of trying to study Holocaust survivors, and we did. And I'll show you some of those findings. And in the course of doing this work, which had never been done before, in Holocaust survivors, many people, when asked about if they had ever gone to treatment for their problems, said that they hadn't gone to treatment and identified the fact that that there was nowhere to really go and who could possibly understand what had happened to them and what could they do about it anyway. The past is the past. And we decided in the early 90s to create a clinic for Holocaust survivors to see if they would come in for treatment. We were learning a lot about how to treat trauma survivors. And what really surprised us was that for every Holocaust survivor that called, maybe three or four children of Holocaust survivors called us, and they said, "We are the casualties of the Holocaust. You should treat us." And, of course, we'll treat anyone that wants to be treated. We became very interested in understanding what they wanted treatment for. We began to call them in for intakes and eventually develop psychotherapy groups for them. Over the course of the 10 years that this program was active, we had more than 40 or 50 groups, different groups, usually between 10 or 15 sessions long, of different Holocaust survivors, sometimes intergenerational groups. And what was really fascinating was that the same issues came up over and over again. What brings you to treatment was the question. Feelings of being different or damaged, daily intrusions of Holocaust-related imagery, problems separating from parents, leading to problems in interpersonal relationships, feeling the burden of compensating for past losses, anxiety, depression, guilt. Most attributed problems to being raised by Holocaust survivors, which was really interesting, but the deep sense that one got from this group of people was that although they were in their 40s or 50s or 60s, they were very much defining themselves in relation to their parents, which is quite unusual, because most people at that age have children, they had children too, have husbands, have lives, have wives, or partners. The fact of who their parents are isn't really the most salient part of the conversation and isn't central to their mental health picture, and that is what really intrigued us. So we wanted to see what the literature might say about adult children of Holocaust survivors, mostly so that we could better understand what their issues were. And what was remarkable in the early 90s was that the academic literature was really full of articles, mostly written by first and second generation Holocaust researchers, that were intent on dispelling the myth of damage to the second generation. And it was really quite extraordinary. The basic idea was that survivors are resilient and their offspring are successful, And at around the time that Mouse came out, a book came out called Against All Odds by William Helmreich that really argued for the remarkable adaptive capacities of Holocaust survivors, their enormous resilience, and the fact that it had also affected children in much the same way. They had achieved high socioeconomic status, which was true, high educational status, which was true. And in all those measures, that all the boxes you can check for success, it was argued that, wow, considering what happened, these are remarkable people. And the only question was, were they like that and that's why they survived, or something else? But the idea that they were damaged really was not part of the conversation in any way or affected. And of course, there were people that had problems. Everyone knew that. But the argument was that neither Holocaust survivors nor their children are any more damaged than anyone else. There's always people in the society that are going to have problems, and we have to help them. But you can't really blame the Holocaust or survivors for that. And Yael Danieli wrote about this beautifully. She herself is a second-generation Holocaust survivor. She explained it as not wanting to give the Nazis a posthumous victory. And Dr. Danieli was one of the first people that really understood that there were very different responses to the Holocaust, and was one of the first people that really wrote about the fact that the Holocaust did not affect survivors and their families in a uniform manner. The point that I want to make is that in the field of trauma, and certainly in the field of Holocaust studies, there are politics of victimization and survivorship that really enter the conversation. Just the terminology of whether somebody is a victim or a survivor of trauma is a very political idea. And it has a lot of implications. How people want to be seen is very tough. When you talk about Holocaust, you want to document the horrors and consequences of the Holocaust in order to validate the experience, but you want to be careful about how you pathologize the survivor. In the Holocaust, the idea of a biologic marker of something suggesting vulnerability or damage is very sensitive, because it was those very biologic marks that the Nazis used as a justification for exterminating the Jews in the first place. So it's scary for people. Minimizing the scars of the Holocaust is also problematic. And it seemed when we were first getting started, what is the right pitch? If you say we want to see how the Holocaust affected you, it was very hard for people to understand that. We want to know if you're like combat Vietnam veterans. No, they had guns. We want to look at your remarkable resilience qualities. I haven't slept one night since Auschwitz. You know, so anything that was said wasn't exactly right. And so we became very sensitive to this. So there is really an opportunity of scientific inquiry to provide objective data to the question of whether there's an effect of the Holocaust on the second generation, and to do it in a way that might have global significance, because, of course, we're not just talking about the Holocaust. Possibly we're talking about something much more universal than that. So we began very conservatively by asking very simple questions. And there were really three questions. We're interested with whether offspring have more mental health problems than their peers. Who are their peers? Demographically comparable adult Jewish, similarly aged persons whose parents were not in Europe during World War II. Are the problems of Holocaust offspring similar to those of Holocaust survivors? And by then, we had amassed quite a lot of data about Holocaust survivors. And what we were particularly interested in is, are the biologic markers in offspring similar to those in Holocaust survivors? And we tried to speculate about how we would interpret any data that we would find. Now, there are a lot of explanations for, even if you found similar problems in children and parents, you could say that parents model behavior and children learn symptoms or learn to react to their environment in a similar manner as their parents. You could just use a behavioral approach for that, learning theory. You could posit that parents may have deficits in child rearing, for example, that have a set of outcomes that are really not about the Holocaust, but really about deficits in parents. There's also quite a bit of vicarious or imagined trauma directly causing effects. Even therapists report that hearing stories of what happens to their clients or patients can be very traumatizing. And in many homes, the Holocaust was not discussed, but the child imagined it. Then you can assert that the vulnerability is biologically transmitted. What explains symptoms in the parents might explain it in the offspring. But what was particularly intriguing to us was this idea that the response in offspring is a consequence of a change in the parent that occurred in response to the Holocaust that is now being transmitted. And it was interesting to us because that's what would be true intergenerational transmission. And the change may not even be present in the parent. What gets transmitted might be the thing the parent was too late in having, but nonetheless somehow could be transmitted. And there are many examples of this in Jonathan Seckl's work, for example, starvation in pregnancy leading to obesity in adult children. Mother's not obese. Stress in pregnancy leading to smaller birth weight babies that are later more likely to become hypertensive. And what I'll show you a little bit later is variations in maternal care, Michael Meany's work, that can affect stress responses of the adult as an offspring. And what we now know about these kinds of effects, but we may not have known it when we were observing it in real time, is that they are underpinned by epigenetic mechanisms. This was not in the genetic blueprint. It's not part of the structure of the DNA, but rather something happened to the gene that has now made it function differently. And I wish I would have known the word epigenetics when we first started, but it's almost more fun this way, to just imagine what it must be and then to know that there is something that explains it. So our very first study was just to ask, is there a greater prevalence of mental illness in the adult offspring of Holocaust survivors? And we started small. You know, we didn't have a grant for this because we could not formulate how to ask the question or why we were asking, just as I showed you the poetry. There's not a reason, really, to write a grant for this. So we just did the best we could and tried to get people to be in our study, trying to control for those treatment-seeking versus community recruitment. And essentially, we used a rigorous psychological battery, standard diagnostic instruments. And what we found was very clear. We found a threefold greater risk for post-traumatic stress disorder among offspring compared to controls, and 2.5 times more depression. And this was not associated with being treatment-seeking or not being treatment-seeking. And the PTSD was not to the Holocaust, but to events that transpired in the offsprings in their own life. And really, the base rate of PTSD in the population is, depending what study you look at, but anywhere from about 7% to about 15-20%, and here you see we're at 9% for the controls, we're about 30%. So let's say it's a doubling of the risk in the population. All right, so what causes PTSD? I told you earlier that not all trauma survivors develop PTSD, and that really set the field in a search to discover risk factors that would predict who's more vulnerable. And the earlier risk factors, and indeed the politically correct risk factors, have to do with the dose of trauma. The more severe the trauma, the more likely you are to get PTSD. And then it became clear that different rates of PTSD were also a function of the type of exposure, with rape and assault producing very high rates of PTSD in comparison to natural disasters, which produce relatively lower rates of PTSD. And rather than saying that one event is more traumatic than another event, because nobody after natural disasters thanks God that at least they weren't raped, it's very traumatic at the time, people started focusing on subjective interpretation of the event that explains differences in prevalence according to trauma type, what you think about the event and why it happened, your potential role, feelings of guilt. And assault is more likely to bring up those kinds of feelings than natural disaster. Now, how you feel about an event has a lot to do with prior attitudes and experiences. And then the question is, really, where do prior attitudes originate? So I'm digressing for a moment, because by the time you get to a trauma, a lot of things are already in place for you to respond in a certain way. You don't just think, what's my worldview at the time that you are being challenged, right? So we saw this very clearly in New York on 9/11, where many, many people were affected. And while some behavioral responses are universal, as I showed you earlier, where you really begin to see differences, even very early on, is in how people talk about the event or praise the event or think about the event. And of course, what we also now know is that initial hormonal responses are different too in the immediate aftermath of the event. And these hormonal responses are ultimately modulated by what we think. So let's just briefly go through the fight or flight response. The sympathetic nervous system is activated under these conditions, and it results in the release of adrenaline, which results in an increased heart rate, blood pressure, glucose, and arousal. And the catecholamines that are released, the adrenaline, such as norepinephrine, are important for promoting memory of the event. But cortisol is also released from the adrenal gland in response to threat. And one of the important roles of cortisol, not the only role, is to contain the fight or flight response. Cortisol is really involved in both the stress response and its containment, because you know your heart doesn't keep pumping and beating forever. Eventually, within a few hours, the system tries to restore some kind of physiological homeostasis. Now, can you control the magnitude of the stress response? And recent studies have really been focused on this idea that we can influence the amount of adrenaline that is released in the time of a trauma or during stress with our thoughts and with our appraisals. And the reason that it's so important to do that is because being more distressed releases more adrenaline, which will contribute to the formation of intrusive, distressing memories later on. This idea of trying to calm down in the immediate aftermath of a trauma is really important and really, really good advice. So let's take our two people here again. Thoughts that can increase distress have to do with all the cognitions about how safe the world is not and how helpless or incompetent you might be. It is my fault. I'm being punished. The world is not safe. Those are the kind of thoughts that many people have in the immediate aftermath of a trauma that will not calm them down. But thoughts like, I survived, it wasn't my fault, could have been worse, things are going to be okay, are actually things that will bring down the adrenaline. And of course, you can also see the potential role for cortisol, but we'll get to that in a second. What's really important to understand is why would some people have thoughts that increase distress while other people will have thoughts that decrease distress? I mean, where does that come from? And this is a picture that I just love to show. It was brought to my attention by my colleague whose son was going to kindergarten on 9/11 for his very first day of school, and his father, psychotherapist, was escorting him, and he saw the first plane hit the tower, and within an hour they were home, and Adam drew a picture of what happened, and you can see the smoke and the plane and the people falling from the sky. And when Adam's father asked him to explain these little discs on the picture, Adam said that they were the trampolines because he had heard the sirens in the fire department. And what Adam knew going to kindergarten that first day was that although people were falling from the sky, surely they were also being caught by the firemen. And so a cognitive distortion, perhaps, but it was his view, his cognitive appraisal of what was happening at the age of five, which means there had been a setup in his environment for him to favor this kind of an interpretation. Now, I mention this because you might think with that kind of a subjective cognitive appraisal that that might protect people despite what happens to them. And what happened in our study of Holocaust offspring is that when we looked at the actual events that they had been exposed to, it turned out that Holocaust offspring, if anything, had been exposed to fewer and less severe events than controls, but nonetheless, they had responded to those events with more PTSD. Now, we were struggling with the idea of doing research in an ethical way, which really involves the idea that you put in an advertisement and you have people call you. You don't call them. When you do Holocaust studies, you have to understand how just scary the idea is of seeing an advertisement. I mean, Holocaust survivors were rounded up in Europe precisely because ads appeared in the paper asking all Jews to come and register themselves. So the idea of who we might get really troubled us and whether we were getting good and representative information by putting out advertisements really bothered us. So what we did was we went to our original Holocaust sample, which was collected in Cleveland from an epidemiologic sample of people that had already been registered with the Cleveland Historical Society, who we approached and asked to study their children. And that was a very non-biased recruitment. And what we learned from that was that the only offspring that we found that had PTSD in that study had a parent with PTSD, and there was no PTSD in our little study in offspring who did not have at least one parent with PTSD. So then we went back and we did a larger, we looked at the data from that study that I showed you, and what we found was that sure enough, the prevalence of PTSD, but not depression and anxiety, was based on parental PTSD, but parental exposure accounted for depression and anxiety disorders. Now, at some point, we knew that we were not going to always be able to evaluate Holocaust survivors and their children, and we developed a methodology. We were interested in seeing whether adult children of Holocaust survivors had accurate perceptions of their parents' symptomatology, and if so, we could do a we could do a history with an instrument to try to assess parental PTSD and then really learn a lot about offspring. And what we did was we had clinicians interview parents and offspring rate the parent, and we saw that there was a very high concordance. So in some of the studies that I'm going to show you, mostly biologic studies, parental PTSD, unless I tell you otherwise, was examined by the offspring. So moving on to the biologic differences, we were very interested in whether at-risk offspring would have lower cortisol levels and would they demonstrate other cortisol-related alterations associated with PTSD and PTSD risk. Now, by this time, our research effort in understanding the neuroendocrinology of post-traumatic stress disorder, I guess in the first generation, was really growing. And what we had already observed was that both combat veterans and Holocaust survivors, one of the things they had in common was they had lower, in this case, urinary cortisol levels if they had post-traumatic stress disorder than if they did not, or compared to an appropriate control group. And we began to wonder whether having lower cortisol levels might increase the risk for post-traumatic stress disorder to begin with, because if cortisol normally inhibits or contains the sympathetic nervous system, then if they're lower, this might also be something that helps perpetuate distress and high catecholamines. And, oops, that slide didn't turn out good. The slide that had missing information in it that I just showed you was a study that we did. We had begun to do studies evaluating people at the time of the trauma and looking prospectively. And sure enough, people had lower cortisol levels. People who had lower cortisol levels in the immediate aftermath of trauma were more likely to have PTSD at follow-up 4 or 6 months later. So in our group of Holocaust offspring that we had studied for diagnostics, we did a small pilot study and looked at urinary cortisol. And the ones that had PTSD and also parental PTSD had the lowest cortisol levels. But in this very interesting high-risk group, these are persons whose parent had PTSD, but they had not been exposed to a trauma or had PTSD on their own. They also showed significantly lower levels compared to offspring with no parental PTSD or controls. So for the next few biologic studies, all the Holocaust offspring are going to either be in this group or this group, and we're going to exclude people that have had PTSD at any time of their lives so that we can really look at this from a risk perspective. Now, what we had been learning in our studies of PTSD is that lower cortisol levels were a reflection of a greater dysregulation of the stress system. And what we were particularly focused on were glucocorticoid receptors. And what we learned through a variety of methodologies is that these receptors were more sensitive in the brain and in the periphery in people with PTSD. We could do that by injecting cortisol or synthetic cortisol and looking at either the hormonal response or the brain response using PET imagery. We had also seen evidence that the brain is involved in low cortisol levels because of our circadian rhythm studies. We saw alterations in cortisol metabolism. And what was striking to us about these differences were that they were distinct from those that are typically associated with stress. I mean, stress is typically associated with high cortisol levels and with major depression, which is highly comorbid with PTSD and also something that's associated with stress. There's a glitch here. That the picture that didn't come out was a picture showing you about glucocorticoid receptors. And the point that I wanted to make about it is that the amount of cortisol that is circulating in your blood is really not an accurate index of the biologic activity of cortisol, because for cortisol to have any effects, it has to bind to receptors. So in major depression, there are high levels of circulating cortisol, but they don't bind that well to the receptors. There are fewer receptors in the brain and periphery. And so the cortisol is present, but it may not be as biologically active. In PTSD, there are more glucocorticoid receptors, and they're more biologically active. One way that you can measure that, as I said, is by giving synthetic hormones like dexamethasone, which is a synthetic cortisol, using the DST, the dexamethasone suppression test. And when you look at this test, what it does, this is the baseline, the pre-dexamethasone day, and this is what happens to cortisol levels after dexamethasone. And what you see here is that cortisol levels went down much further in this group than it did in these two groups, and that is arguably because the glucocorticoid receptors are more sensitive to this very low dose of hormone. And so we saw this repeatedly in post-traumatic stress disorder, but now we're seeing it in Holocaust offspring who have the risk factor of parental PTSD. Are you guys with me so far? Yeah? Okay. So something's going on with my slides, and not all of them are popping in. but the one that you just didn't see was a study of circadian rhythm of cortisol. And how you do that is you stick an IV in and you have somebody hospitalized in a clinical research center, and you take cortisol, you withdraw cortisol every half hour around the clock for 24 hours. And what you get is not only a beautiful graph showing their cortisol levels lower in PTSD, but you can also look at how cortisol release is organized through the day. And one of the things that you can look at is the dynamic range of cortisol. And you can do that by comparing the cortisol at its peak to the mean cortisol levels. And in major depression, although the mean is higher, the peak is, the difference here is lower. A narrow range reflects a smaller dynamic range of cortisol and less reactivity. But in PTSD, the mean was lower, the peak was higher. And that's reflective of a highly active, reactive system, even though cortisol levels are lower. And again, when we looked at Holocaust offspring, you can clearly see these blue guys. These are Holocaust offspring with parental PTSD, not their own PTSD, and their cortisol levels are lower. And repeatedly, what we kept observing is that there was a relationship between cortisol in offspring and PTSD symptoms in their parents as they rated those PTSD symptoms. And we wanted to try to understand this. So we asked Holocaust offspring, why do you think your cortisol levels might be low? We didn't actually ask them that way, but we asked them a lot about what they felt the origin was of some of their problems. And one of the scales we asked them to fill out is a scale that we use a lot in our research. It's called the Childhood Trauma Questionnaire. And it assesses kind of maltreatment on many domains. And what you can see here is, there's got to be a way to go back. No, this is... What you can see here is that Holocaust offspring reported more emotional abuse and emotional neglect if they had parental PTSD, and kind of dose-response way, having two parents with PTSD, more emotional abuse and neglect, not more sexual abuse, physical neglect, or physical abuse, however. So we just thought low cortisol is an accumulation of this history of emotional abuse that offspring were reporting preferentially in PTSD. But it turned out that we were wrong. And we learned this by studying a very interesting cohort of people, women who were pregnant on 9/11 and had to evacuate the World Trade Center. We were able to study these women and their babies for the first 2 years after 9/11. And what we saw, interestingly, was that mothers who had developed PTSD in response to 9/11 had lower cortisol levels compared to mothers who did not. Not a surprise to us by then. But their babies also had lower cortisol levels. And this was obtained at the 7-month healthy baby visit. So this wasn't about emotional abuse or years of emotional abuse. And the correlation was even more profound between salivary cortisol level in babies and severity of PTSD in mothers that we obtained. Babies are not rating their mothers. And so there's a real relationship here, just like we had seen in the offspring. At 2 years old, we asked the mothers a series of questions behaviorally about their offspring. And it turned out that one of the biggest findings was that even at age 2, infants would report more distress at novelty. And it was very reminiscent of this finding in adult Holocaust offspring, where maternal PTSD, in this case, was more associated with trait anxiety in offspring. Now, the thing that really had a deep effect on us was that there was a trimester effect here. And really, cortisol levels were lower, not different in the first trimester between women who did and didn't develop PTSD in their babies. But in the middle of the second trimester or by the third trimester, you start to see that there is a real difference in cortisol levels occurring at this time. And so we wondered whether low cortisol in offspring could originate from in utero effects. And by this time, I was working with Dr. Seckel here, who believes that the answer to all of life's questions is 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase type 2. And this is an enzyme that is in the placenta, and it protects the fetus from the effects of maternal glucocorticoids. It develops around the second trimester, and how, you might ask, could it do such a thing? How could we buy this stuff? How can you be protected from stress hormones? Well, it's just a simple matter. The difference between active cortisol and its inactive metabolite cortisone, for example, is just one little hydrogen molecule here that pops off because of this enzyme, and here's a double bond and an oxygen. And this is how the body uses chemistry to really change things around. Babies born to mothers under stress, not Holocaust, just in general, show changes in the activity of this enzyme, and the change may not necessarily be detrimental, although in many cases it does lead to risk for hypertension and obesity. Now, we were able to look at this in our Holocaust offspring, and we were able to find that there were, in fact, changes in this enzyme, and changes in this enzyme could arguably be responsible for lower glucocorticoid production and potentially increased glucocorticoid responsiveness in the liver and kidney. And one idea here is that this might be an ideal metabolism for starvation, but if you're not starving, it might be the kind of metabolism that results in obesity and metabolic syndrome if food is in abundance. And we happen to have also looked at this, Jonathan and I published a paper in Holocaust survivors, and the effects were strongest in those who had been children or who were young during the Holocaust. So at this time, it was not on our radar that there was going to be an in utero thing. We were mostly thinking about having parents raise you and living in a life with parents that were affected. And so we went back to our Holocaust data, which was by then really growing, and we just wanted to ask a very simple question going back. If had we divided the sample not by parental PTSD but by maternal and paternal PTSD, would any of the things that I showed you be different? And these are the same data that I showed you from the 280 people who we did the diagnostics on. And it turned out that the prevalence of PTSD was actually greater just in association with maternal PTSD or when both parents had PTSD. Very surprised. It was a post hoc analysis. And here are the rest of the data. This was not true for depression and not true for anxiety, where mothers and fathers really had equal risk for depression and anxiety disorder, either based on their PTSD status or their exposure status. When we went back to the study that I showed you with the circadian rhythm in Holocaust offspring, and I'm just going to show you the mean because having all those graphs would be very squiggly. When we just got to the mean cortisol, there was a significantly low cortisol in association with maternal PTSD, a little bit for fathers, but in our urinary cortisol data, if anything, fathers were not in the middle, and lower urinary cortisol was observed as a function of maternal PTSD. And we have a measure of glucocorticoid receptor sensitivity in lymphocytes that we've been working on, where we actually give the dexamethasone to the cells itself, and people don't have to take it. And the lower, this is called an IC50 of an enzyme that's activated when we do this, the lower the enzyme, the more responsive the cell is to glucocorticoids. And this IC50 measure, too, was in association with maternal PTSD. If anything, fathers had offspring with paternal PTSD had higher IC50, which is more consistent with depression and lack of glucocorticoid sensitivity. Okay. So there's clearly a mother thing happening in our Holocaust offspring data, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's all in utero. The work of Michael Meany shows that there are very important postnatal effects that influence stress responses in offspring, and they're based on maternal care. Now, some might argue that some of these postnatal differences would correspond to prenatal in humans, but the idea here is in very elegant studies, quite convincingly, been demonstrated that cortisol levels in offspring can be changed in the rodent by a mother that shows a lot of licking and grooming. And the more licking and grooming, the lower the cortisol, just like we've observed. The lower the cortisol response to dexamethasone, just like we observed. And the offspring of Holocaust survivors kind of look like this. And it's not in utero because cross-fostering studies shows that this is really a behavior-driven phenomenon. And it's really a proof of concept that the maternal behavior changes the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. But wait, you might say to me, licking and grooming, that's good. That's been associated with the good phenotype, right? It's those bad daycare mothers that don't, lick and groom. That's been associated with the bad phenotype or depression. But really, you have to be very careful on how you interpret rat behavior because I'm a big believer in interviewing subjects, and it's really one of the limitations of animal work. They can't tell us how they feel about all that licking and grooming, and what looks like good mothering may, for all we know, be good smothering. And in fact, many Holocaust parents hovered over their children and probably seemed like they were playing a very active and positive parenting role. Oh, I can't believe that I don't have this picture here. There's something funky that happened when I cut in slides. But these gorgeous, gorgeous correlations showed that there was a relationship between low cortisol and parental overprotection in mothers, but not fathers. So, are fathers unimportant to intergenerational transmission or to cortisol and risk? And, of course not. I would be wrong to suggest that. But fathers and mothers may have different contributions, and fathers may pass things along epigenetically through germ cells, whereas mothers may pass through more easily in utero, and both can pass through behaviors. And you see a beautiful paradigm of socially defeated male rats who produce socially defeated male offspring. So definitely fathers are involved. And so now the question is, we have all these beautiful observations. sorry. What is the molecular underpinning, and is this about epigenetics? And I think that you may all know by now that epigenetics describes changes that occur to the gene, that changes the way the gene functions. DNA can be transcribed into RNA through the process of transcription, where RNA is synthesized as an analog of DNA by just reading these bases and creating the opposite base pair analog. But what happens is it's possible to misread the recipe when methyl groups can be added to the cellular environment, which can be done depending on the conformation of how the DNA is wound onto histones. And what can happen is that methyl groups can become more available within the nucleosome, and in the presence of the correct enzyme can alter the function of the gene, and this can also be adaptive. So one sign that we look for is methylation on the cytosine base, and all that that means is that the CH3 group has been added to this position. Just a carbon and three little hydrogens, and it has a huge effect because when this methyl group is on this molecule and DNA is trying to make an analog, it won't read this. It'll just either skip over it or stop. But this can really have very big repercussions. Whoops. Oh, there you go. All right. So what you can do now in the lab is you can look for these islands on a location of a gene where you think there might be methylation, and you can measure it. And the question we had was, could we measure it in the lymphocyte or in blood cells, and would it be actually meaningful? And what we decided to do in the beginning, working with Michael Meany, was to look at the gene that he thought, the glucocorticoid receptor gene, was associated with maternal licking and grooming in the hippocampus in rats. And we looked at the same promoter region of the gene in lymphocytes using his primers, which is this region over here. And the reason this is an important region is that it contains the binding site for the glucocorticoid receptor gene expression, meaning if there would be changes in methylation here, this could arguably affect the way that the gene is expressed, even in the lymphocyte, so it might be important. Now, our hypothesis, and we had one this time, contrast to former years where we were just looking, was that if the glucocorticoid receptor is more sensitive, what you'd see is decreased methylation, and that that would be associated with increased PTSD and PTSD risk. And recently, we completed a study. It's quite a large group of Holocaust offspring and controls where we found lower methylation in association with maternal PTSD, but really not with paternal PTSD. And we're also finding it in PTSD, not in Holocaust survivors anymore. But these are combat veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's a pretty big sample, and there is a reduced methylation in association with PTSD. These are the 39 CPG regions that we looked at. But back to the Holocaust offspring, when you examine these individuals, we're starting to ask really a lot more questions about how the Holocaust has affected them. And what methylation seems to be most related to is reporting that you have subjective psychological scars as a result of the Holocaust. It's also seen more in association with maternal PTSD, not resilience, not sensitivity to violence. And there's also one more gene that I want to briefly talk about because we just looked at this recently. A colleague of ours, Elizabeth Binder at Max Planck Institute, measured FKBP5 methylation in a region that she looks at, which is not the promoter region, but it's a very interesting region of the gene that in her work has been associated with childhood trauma. So we happened to have leftover blood samples that we were allowed to use for any purpose from Holocaust survivors and their own children that we had collected years earlier when we were studying both in tandem. And we looked at this gene. It's a chaperone of the glucocorticoid receptor and arguably plays a very important role in how the gene, the glucocorticoid receptor, might bind to cortisol. And what we found was actually very, very interesting, that in this case, this is the blood from parents. There were no differences in FKBP5 methylation in this region called intron 7, if you're interested, between Holocaust survivors and controls. But in the children of these parents, their very own children, worth it. The Holocaust offspring show lower FKBP5, similar to the directionality that's been reported for childhood trauma. Now, in our lab, we're actually looking at a different region of this gene that has the promoter region in it, and our hypothesis is that PTSD would be associated with increased FKBP5 methylation in the promoter region, and that that might be related to PTSD because we've observed lower FKBP5 gene expression in PTSD. But that's why we wanted her to look at it in her stable gene, stable location, because it's very interesting. It gets even more interesting because you can correlate the FKBP5 measures in the parents and their children. And here are the controls, and here are the Holocaust offspring and survivors. Now, I think 0.379 for 10 people is kind of good. It can go either way. But this is really amazing. This is the correlation between the parent and the child's FKBP5 methylation in an area that is supposed to be associated with trauma exposure. And what's really interesting is if you look at this based on the gender of the parent, the correlation is very strong when you look at mothers' FKBP5 and their children, but not fathers. I don't think this is going to get better with age, with more. And there's really not more because I think we're done studying Holocaust survivors now. But let's talk for a few minutes, wind down. What are the implications of this work? Well, number one, the effects of trauma are passed to the next generation somehow. There's no reason to believe that this won't be more generalizable to other genes and to other systems. We haven't looked there, but certainly there was reason to look at the things we looked at, and we found what we found in those systems. Developmentally programmed changes allow for more flexible responding, but only when there is a good match between what the person needs to cope with and the tools they've been given to cope with them. Now, the other thing that's really important is that pregnancy and early postnatal periods are really important, critical periods. We have to really take care of people, mothers, during those periods. Biologic effects may be mediated by parental or maternal attachments also. And I just want to put the clinical perspective back into all of this molecular biology, because what's actually happening when a trauma survivor is pregnant and in the early postpartum period is that this is a time when the trauma survivor is really being reactivated. The past is really coming in and intruding on the mother, let's call it that. The past is occupying, certainly in the Holocaust parent, a lot of space that would have otherwise been devoted to the current life of a child. If you go to the Holocaust Museum Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, beautiful. It's incredible what they've done. They have these videos of survivors that are constantly coming on and off. And the day that I was giving such a talk in Israel, I went to Yad Vashem and was just transfixed by a story of a woman saying how after she got married, she told her husband she would never have children. She would never want children born into this kind of world. She had lost everyone. And she was really adamant about it, but she found herself somehow pregnant in the DP camp. And she told the story on the tape of how she tried to terminate her own pregnancy. She put irons on her belly. She was sure that she was not going to bring this child into the world. And then, of course, she did bring the child into the world. And how it took years for her to kind of accommodate to this and really see the good in it. And, of course, been glad she didn't terminate. Could you imagine the preoccupation that this woman had at that time? How could it not affect normal attachments? And it does. It disrupts the caregiving and it disrupts the care receiving. So how does that work exactly? So the parent may not consciously remember the starvation, for example, but the emotional experience is transmitted through a preoccupation with food and feeding. What the child learns to do is respond by either trying to control the parent through food or become controlled by food. Many Holocaust offspring have food issues of either being very, very thin or very, very heavy. But certainly what came up often as a theme in our group was how you could really, really irritate your mother by not eating dinner. But it becomes a very big thing. When a child playfully tries to run away from her parent, the parent will grasp tighter rather than the normal thing of letting the child go and playing with them. The child is trying to individuate and separate. It's a game. We're supposed to let them go and come back. But the child may never learn to give anyone any space or tolerate separation because the normal way in which you give a child separateness is gone. When a little girl is innocently trying to compete with her mother for her father's attention by flirting with her daddy, the mother may snip off her hair, as her captives did to her in the camps, rather than allow the child to sort of develop that kind of a relationship. What does the child learn? The child learns that he is powerless or powerful in the extreme both ways. When a parent sees a uniformed police, they may freeze in fear. What does the child learn? The world, even good people, may be very, very bad. And you can't really trust the good guys. Parent will overreact to health issues. The child will overreact to health issues and become overly concerned with somatics. Fear of loss makes the parent reluctant to love fully. The child will not understand why they are not loved fully. And they won't understand the void and the emptiness they feel as a result of that. When a child or the parent may not be able, or the child may not be able to love their spouse or their child in the same way. When a child becomes the age of the parent during World War II, there is a lot more reliving. And many people came into therapy exactly at the age when their children became the age that they were. They were flooded with memories, very angry at the child at that age for not somehow knowing or understanding or behaving the way that they were supposed to behave with that kind of a reverence. This is not confined to Holocaust survivors. This happens with women who were raped and abused. When the child becomes the age that they were when they were abused, same thing. And they cannot necessarily recognize the change, and that's usually a good psychotherapist can recognize it. So the child responds in all the ways that I mentioned because the behaviors create a need for a biologic accommodation. And one occurs because the body can accommodate during this time. And the only thing that we don't really know yet is how long does the critical period last. And we think epigenetics happens really during a critical period. I'm sure that's not true for every gene. I'm sure that we're going to learn that epigenetics is a mechanism that's viable throughout life. But we're just in the beginning of it. Now the big question is, will the effects be transmitted from second to third generation? We're studying it, but my hunch is that if the behaviors in the offspring occur, then the effects will be transmitted. The first generation, however, does not transmit to the third. Holocaust survivors are fantastic grandparents. Vietnam veterans are fantastic grandparents, and they all say, I wish I could have been a better parent. But there is an ability that they have to be attached to their grandchild that was not present, and they can acknowledge was not present in the same way with the second generation. So The other thing that's really interesting is this idea that although epigenetic changes are enduring, they're also reversible. I'm not showing you these data, but we are doing studies where we're looking at epigenetic changes before and after psychotherapy and finding some. What stands in the way of changing enduring patterns is often the idea that change may be a betrayal to the legacy of the Holocaust or any form of trauma survivorship. Many people feel that their very transformation pays honor to the people that were lost, and there is a desire to hold on to it rather than let it go. But when people want to let it go, what the science of epigenetics gives us hope about is the fact that they may be able to do it. And the most hopeful thing is, and we say this a lot in therapy, if an environment can cause symptoms and result in an enduring transformation in one way, then surely the environment can transform the other way. It can't possibly only be one direction. If the environment can result in change, then negative events can result in more negative changes, but positive events can surely result in more positive ones. Thank you very much.